I've already done the gag of this episode of The Writer and the Critic has been filmed in front
you
of a live studio.
You have done it
again. Why can't I do it again?
No, it's not funny.
It is funny.
Was it funny the first time?
It was. You're just a liar.
I'm not a liar. It wasn't funny the first time.
Whatever.
I just put in the laugh track. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. Sitting beside me is your other host, Ian Mond, and we are recording live at Continuum 10 in Melbourne, which is very exciting. We have an actual audience, and we also have two actual guests who are also actual guests of honour at the convention. It's really, really exciting. So sitting, for those listening at home, you need to picture them sitting way over on the other side of the room. We have Amberlinque Mulliner and Jim C. Hines. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Jim, feeling good?
Can you see us?
Hello.
Can you see it? You're quite far away.
I'm doing great over here. Thanks. We're good.
It is very strange. It's almost like we're just sitting at the table on our own.
Yeah.
Everyone's really far away.
And there's these random two people to our left who are just, you know, for some reason sitting there and won't stop talking.
Apparently there's like a minimum safe distance.
There is.
OH&S regulations. You're an American. You won't understand this. But OH&S regulations in Victoria and specifically Australia are quite stringent. So these minimum distances have to be, you know, held by. Can we edit that out?
No. I'm going to talk about trucks now. Or...
Shut up, Kirsten.
Anyway. So I'm going to tell everybody listening at home and also the good people here at Continuum a little bit about our guests that I gleaned from the interwebs. So feel free to correct me if the interwebs are wrong, as they often are. Amberlin is an Aboriginal writer and illustrator from the Ballacoo people who hail from the Pilbara in Western Australia. She has written and illustrated a number of award-winning picture books for children, which are beautiful. And she is in the very middle of writing, or bringing out at least, a young adult dystopian series, which is the Tribe series. And the first book, The Interrogation of Ashala Wolf, came out...
2012.
Mm-hmm. And the second book, The Disappearance of Ember Crow, came out last year and is available in the dealer's room for everybody who's here. You can go get copies of both books. And when does the third book drop?
Probably towards the end of this year. That's the one I'm working on at the moment.
Very nice. So you're still in writing mode.
Very much.
Are we
so.
Taking away writing time from you right now by doing this podcast?
Little bit. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. A little bit resentful over here.
Yeah. Is 10 minutes past 2 in the afternoon prime writing time for you?
Any time I can find a spare minute. Yeah. It's prime writing time for
okay.
me.
So are you ducking up to the hotel room in between panels?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Are you serious?
Yes, seriously.
That's dedication.
Wow. I thought that was like, because I don't write, I thought that was just like what writers say, but they never do.
No, I have a full-time job, so the writing I have to snatch every second I can.
How do you go about with that in terms of night times, coming home from work?
I don't sleep much. I come home and I write.
Wow.
That's what writers do, Ian.
You'd be surprised how little sleep you can function on. People tell you need sleep, but they're lying, really.
No, so seriously, so you do a full day's work, but what about your juices, the energy juices, the creative?
Juices?
Yes. Well, I'm just saying the creative. Anyway, it means something different in other countries. The creative juices, aren't they like gone by 6 o'clock in the evening? Don't you just want to sit and watch the news and a current affair?
Well, I do, but if I want to write a novel, it's no good sitting and
yeah,
watching.
I understand the practicalities, but I'm just saying.
And it would probably be rubbish TV, reality TV rather than the news and a current affair, to be honest, but yeah.
For people who have full-time jobs, I do, but that's I don't write, so it doesn't really mean anything to me. But for others, what do you recommend? Like close the door, you come home, close the door, have something to eat and straight to the writing, or do
basically just force yourself.
Wow. Okay. Kirsten, you don't have that problem.
Oh. You're kidding. Yeah.
It's pointy stick type of weather today.
It is. The pointy stick does not travel. G, Jim. Jim is very interesting. Jim, for those of you who are listening at home, gave a wonderful guest of honour speech at Continuum early today. He will be posting it to his blog when he returns home from the wilds of Australia. It was a very good speech. You should all go look that up, and I will provide a link when it is made available. Jim's first novel was about goblins, and he also wrote a series about princesses who aren't at all Disney, which I really need to get a hold of. Really need to get a hold of.
It's very good.
Yes, I've been told, and it's like, princesses, oh, I don't know. No, but here's what they do. It's like, I must have those books. and you're currently in the middle of your Ex Libri series, which is a...
Well, he's a super... Oh, you can answer your own... No, you can... Why am I answering that question?
I don't know why you're answering that question. It's very rude, Ian.
Sorry.
It's not just us today.
Yes, no.
I am curious. I'd like to hear about these books. Are they any good?
Well, I was going to say... Anyway, no, please answer.
No, it's basically magic-using librarian from Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and he pulls things out of books. So nice. Laser blasters, lightsabers, magic potions, a pet spider who sets things on fire, that sort of thing.
You have a thing about pet spiders, don't you?
I like the spider.
So one of your goblin had a pet spider.
And that is actually the spider that Isaac pulls out for the Libriomancer books.
Oh, nice.
Because this was... Partly, it turns out the spider is the most popular character I've ever written, which is odd. I'm not quite sure how to react to that. But
he's pretty awesome.
He is. He runs around, and if he doesn't like you, he sets you on fire.
That's right.
And if he's scared, he sets you on fire.
But like my four-year-old.
He's kind of a one-trick spider.
Yeah. So you're writing this new series. Was it simply an excuse to come up with that idea so you could geek out and basically reference every one of your favourite authors from since you've been reading books?
It was not just an excuse to do that. But that was certainly a factor. I've read a lot of stuff lately that, I have nothing against grimdark. There's a place for the dark, gritty fantasy, but it's not really my thing.
Yeah.
I want it to be fun. I want this guy to be sitting there doing magic and going... This is sweet. I just made a lightsaber. My life is awesome. And yes, I'm getting chased by a sparkling vampire, and that sucks, but I can shoot it with a phaser. I want him to love magic. I want him to just completely geek out for the whole story of all of the possibilities, all of the things he can do, and just... I want it to recapture that sense of wonder. That sense of, hey... We read fantasy because it's sweet, and we want to go home and daydream about it. And this is it's basically a book for all of the people who go home at night and lie in bed and think about the news story of the day and say, man, if I was Batman, I could have fixed that.
Yeah, and that definitely comes out. I mean, he's not a guy who's pulling stuff out of Ulysses or Tom Wolfe, or he's going straight to the fan, because, and it makes sense, because that's where all the good shit is. So
pretty much,
yeah. And that's what it's. Look, let's be honest. It's an idea that I had.
Oh, is it now?
For a book series?
That's such a shame. You didn't actually write it.
No,
Jim wrote it. So
well,
that's the
go.
Difference between having the idea and having the book.
Well, that's what I was trying to get tips from Amblin about when you come home from work and the juices. I mentioned the juices. So.
Juices. With the word of the podcast.
We got to get you some extra juices.
And the second book's out.
The second book is out.
And are you sneaking off to places to write the third, or is that already written?
The third one is turned in.
To
final
nice.
Revisions. And yes, I am not as disciplined as Amblin. If I sneak off, it's going to be to go eat junk food or go hide from drought bears.
Is there a fourth?
There will be a fourth book in the series.
Okay.
I don't know what it's called yet, because I had a title and everybody told me it sucked.
Aww.
So it's currently just book four.
That's a really good title. Oh, the book where stuff happens. That's an awesome title.
Yeah, the book where more stuff happens.
What was the title? Come on, you can say. You said you told everyone.
You totally did. I knew as soon as Jim said that.
He
opened himself up. I mean, I told everyone. They all said it was crap. Well, we're an audience.
We want to hear the crap. Yeah,
exactly. We can tell you it's crap.
The first book was Libriomancer. The second book was Codex Born. The third book will be Unbound. And so I was looking for book terms, and I came across that there was this actual term, bibliochasm.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it sounds bookish and Latinish and all of that.
But and end of worldish.
And what?
End of worldish. It sounds apocalyptic.
Yeah, pretty much.
Chasm.
What is a bibliochasm?
I don't know. Oh. I don't remember.
Well, not the title of his book. That's right.
Not the title of his book.
I remember it sounded cool. And that was pretty much all I needed.
If anyone in the audience wants to look up bibliochasm on your devices and let us know later on, I'll be very interested. Oh, we've just had... Okay, so
there
we've had
go.
A definition.
That, I like that.
A person who mutilates...
I should use that.
Yes.
A person who mutilates or destroys books.
Well, I think you should tell your friends to shove it up their clacker, because that's a great title, and you should use it.
I mean, well, when I said friends, I meant agent and editor.
Ah, okay.
powerful friends.
Yeah. Powerful friends.
Them being the people who sign the checks.
Yeah. Don't tell them to clacker it up, don't.
Yeah, there will be
clacker
no clackering.
It up.
That's my Aussie staying, all right?
Stop.
Copyright Ian. Okay. Did you...
Sorry. No, I was actually... Because you sidetracked me with asking Anne Boleyn about how she wrote, and I wanted to actually ask her what her trilogy is about in a nutshell.
Wow,
I know,
that's
it's horrible,
tough.
Isn't it?
Yeah. It's four books. It's dystopian. It's really hard to talk about without giving away a twist, for which people do not forgive me if I do, so I try not to do that. It's set in a future world and a society that's in lots of ways is really good but oppresses people who are born with abilities. It centres around a group of teenagers who live in a forest and call themselves a tribe. The main character is Indigenous, and I drew obviously a lot on my Indigenous heritage to write her, to write the relationships the tribe has with animals, and to write the government and the laws and the detention system, some of which is drawn from my family's experiences under the Stolen Generations.
Excellent. You prepped that.
No, I summarised a lot, yeah. And also to teenagers, short attention span.
Yeah,
so, yeah, you've got to be quick.
Excellent. Yeah. So there will be four books in
yes.
series when it's finished, so you are halfway through at the moment.
Yeah.
How sensitive do you need to be in terms of how you write the books? Given that you're drawing from your own culture, do you still need to be sensitive in how you
do yes.
it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very, very sensitive.
Have you self-censored yourself?
Well, from our perspective, it's not censorship. Censorship is a Eurocentric liberalist tradition concept. It's not an Indigenous concept. From our perspective, there are rules about what you say and who can say it and to who, and those rules are very important. So I check what I say and other members of my family check what I say so that I'm absolutely sure that it's all right.
Oh, okay. That's really... I hadn't thought about it like that, obviously. That's really interesting. Okay.
No, it is. I think I look at ideas of censorship as something that is... And any decision a creator makes while they're creating the work, that's not... I mean, to use the word censorship to that is very problematic, because creators make decisions all the time about what to put in their work and why they put it in it or choose to leave it out, and that's part of the process of doing it. And they'll do that for creative reasons, they'll do that for reasons of respect to material that they may be drawing from, they do it for all sorts of reasons. So I kind of view censorship as something that comes from outside,
external,
and what other people say. Once you have the work, or you know, it doesn't have to be when it's finished, you could be pitching and stuff, but if it's other people saying no, we won't let you do that, that's different. But self-censorship is a word I have a problem with.
It's one of my little bugbears.
I know.
not the censorship thing, but the thing about writing from culture, because being Jewish, that would be me, you can still write as a Jew and put your identity in as a Jew, but that doesn't mean you won't get it wrong, and you won't do things that would either stereotype your faith, stereotype your culture, even if you're writing from the culture. And so I'm always interested when people write from the culture, what sort of where they're at, because at the same time you're trying to communicate to an audience that won't be of the culture, and you don't want to have, you know, scads of exposition in there and that sort of thing.
No, the story needs to tell itself.
Correct,
yeah.
That's right.
And the difficult thing is you're not just talking to an audience that knows nothing, you're talking to an audience where what they do know is probably wrong.
Yes, that's correct.
So that creates another layer of difficulty.
Because for me it was always Chaim Potok. Everyone would come up and say, oh, Ian, have you read The Chosen? Is it The Chosen? I can't remember because I never read them. Interestingly, they were never prescribed at my Jewish school to read. And yet all my non-Jewish friends would always ask, have you read this and is it accurate about Chassidic Jews? And I said, well, first off, it's Hasidic, not Chassidic. And second off, I haven't read them, so I don't know. And also, whatever Fran Drescher does on The Nanny is incorrect. So not necessarily connected to the Potter thing. But you find that those challenges are there as well with you.
Because yes.
That's why you go to your family and go to your...
Yeah. You need other people's opinion who are experts in the culture. So, yes.
Do you have the same issue, Jim?
Sometimes. Probably not to the same level. But, yeah, I think a lot of it... And again, I would join with Kirsten in saying, it's not censorship, man. Come on. We will all gang up on you.
Well, it's just people write to say they self-censor. I'm sorry.
We're going to censor you from using that word. You are no longer allowed to use that word.
Never again.
Okay.
Actually, ironically, it's mostly people don't say themselves, I self-censor. It's other people who are deeply worried about writers having to self-censor themselves. Seriously, yeah. I mean, that's usually where I see the term used.
Okay.
But people asking people, do you self-censor?
I have been schooled. I've been schooled with a K, and I'll never do it again. Thank you.
But in terms, the current series. Let's look at the Libriomancer series.
Yeah.
You know, main character is, you know, this dude from the Upper Peninsula. My wife, her family spends a lot of time up north, and it is its own culture. It's one that I've hung out with a lot, but it's not my culture. So I'll still run things past her, check in with the in-laws that, is this right? One of the kind of embarrassing things is when I was finishing up the first book and getting ready to go out and start doing readings, I had to ask my wife, how do I pronounce my main character's name? Because it's, and I'm going to mess it up because, yeah, but it's Isaac Vainio. And in Finnish, you pronounce every letter, every vowel. And say, oh, I would have just pronounced that Vainio. And she looks at me. Same thing if I say sauna instead of sauna. But then, in addition to the main character, you know, I go on the internet and I talk about, we need more diversity. We need a broader range of characters. And then sitting down and trying to do that, I want to do this respectfully. One of the characters in the books is autistic. And it's not a major plot point. It's not the story about her being autistic. That's just who she is. But I have, you know, asked other people to read this and tell me, does this feel true to your experience? And, of course, everybody has their own experience. So when they say no, okay, does it feel plausible? Or does it feel like I just watched Rain Man and that's what I'm using as my basis for knowledge? Likewise, different characters, different cultures that are coming in. The first book, it's all about Gutenberg and how he established this magical organization 500 years ago because he invented printing and movable type. And in the second book, we acknowledge, yeah, no, he didn't. He did, but he wasn't the first one. Over in China, they were doing that hundreds of years before. It's just we don't learn that in school because they're not white.
Yeah.
So bringing in this second organization that's based on China and having to then slow down a lot more and do a lot more research and try to do it respectfully and recognizing I'm going to screw it up. I'm going to get some of this wrong, but asking people for input, asking for help, and then once it comes out, listening when they tell me, dude, just no.
And that's an important part of it, isn't it? I think there's a lot of concern and possibly some faux concern about the idea that, well, writers will just stop writing anything that's not outside of themselves because they'll be worried that they'll get, you know, stomped on the internet. But it's just a matter of, you know, acknowledging that people will make mistakes.
Yeah.
But what happens at the point the mistake is made and someone points it out is the real significant thing, because someone who stands their ground and says, well, blah, 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 no, blah, 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 that's kind of where the heat on the internet comes from, as opposed to someone who stands back and says, yeah, sorry, messed that one up, try to do better next time.
It's the doubling down on the mistake.
Yeah, it is, it is. So, yes, no, people should not be afraid at all to write lots of different diverse characters and settings and themes, and just expect that, as with any part of creative work, you'll make mistakes and just say sorry
as
and mean it.
As long as they go about it in the right way, I would add to that. You know,
yes.
10 minutes on the internet is not research.
No, no, Wikipedia is a very...
Wikipedia is not a source.
It's very unreliable way to do your research, but a really good way to get lots of interesting links. Always go down to the bibliographical section, and yeah, it's, I've found that a really good starting point for a lot of things.
I'll use it as a starting point.
Yeah.
Say, okay, this is nice, but where are the footnotes?
Yeah. Where have you got this information from?
Primary sources.
Okay, well, we might jump into the books.
Yeah. Now, you guys recommended the books, so that was good.
Because normally Ian and myself will recommend a book to each other. And
well, I did at first recommend a much longer book.
A much longer book.
Nearly double the length.
But it was uncanny, because Ian sent me an email after Amberlynn recommended the book, and Ian sent me an email and said, I just downloaded this book, it's huge. And about 15 minutes later, I think, Ian, you must have been sitting at home sending out little psychic waves to Amberlynn, because literally it was 15 minutes later I got an email from Amberlynn going, you know, I looked at that book again and it's a bit long. How about we change? So your psychic powers it.
Although, to be fair, Curse of Chamberlain isn't exactly 150 pages long either. However...
It's much shorter than the first one.
Yeah, it is. But still, would you like to introduce the books you recommended?
Yes. So I recommended The Curse of Chalion by Lois Bijou, because she's one of my favourite writers, whether she writes sci-fi or fantasy, and she does both. I love this story because I think it's just an elegantly told fantasy, and in some ways a very classic fantasy. And I like it too because the hero of the book, in lots of ways and very strongly from the start of the book, is really a bit of a broken man. So he's not the traditional image of a hero, and we follow him as he stumbles his way through politics and a curse that needs to be broken, and finds his way to a happy ending. And I'm also quite keen on happy endings, so I like that.
And Jim, yours?
The one I recommended was The Lives of Tau by Wesley Chu. This is actually Wes's first novel, and I kind of hate him for that, because it's fun, and it's well-written, and it's fast-paced, and it holds together, and it's based on the idea that you have these semi-corporeal aliens who crashed on Earth millions of years ago. They can't survive in our atmosphere. They have to inhabit some of the life forms here on Earth, you know, whether those were dinosaurs, and then eventually these ape things that seem to be getting along pretty well and have a little more brain. And they've had this millions of years that they're trying to help us evolve to the point where we can build some rocket ships and send them back home, because, you know, not completely corporeal, they can't survive in our atmosphere, they can't do it on their own. And somewhere along the way, there was a schism that the majority of these aliens decided the best way to help human technology evolve is for them to keep going to war. So we're just going to keep pushing us into war and conflict, and yeah, we'll kill lots of them, but they'll make new toys. And then you have the other faction, which is, well, okay, maybe, but that's a really dickish thing to do, and we should stop it. The book starts when Tau, who is one of the aliens, his host... Okay, I'm spoiling the first chapter for you.
It's a spoil book.
We're going to spoil the whole book.
We're going to talk about the ending.
Okay. There's no... Yeah.
His host dies. And Tau, you know, it's in the middle of a shootout. He doesn't have time to get to a prepared host, somebody who is in good physical and intellectual shape. So he kind of latches on to a guy named Rowan, who is your almost stereotypical basement dwelling, computer tech, out of shape, pizza scarfing guy. And over the course of the book, Tao has to turn Rowan into an actual secret agent. They've got to fight bad guys. They've got to figure out what is this new plot that the other side is up to. And you get little bits at the beginning of each chapter, flashbacks to Tao's other lives. And it's just, the whole thing is a lot of fun. And it's one of those that I'm lying in bed going, I have to go to work in the morning. But this is cool, and there's humor, and there's action, and I'm just going to read one more chapter.
So your book is the one we're going to talk about first.
Okay.
Go on from there.
Yes. And by the way...
Very good summation.
Yes. If the two of you could do that for any future podcasts of ours, because we just read the back of the books. And,
oh, wait. We can do that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, crap.
Usually I complain and whinge and go, oh, but people will have already, because they have to have read it if they don't want to be spoiled, so they'll know what the book's about. So why are we describing what the book's about? And then Kirsten hits me and, yeah, no, it goes on from there.
I'll just cut that bit out.
Why? What? No, I thought that was a... Okay.
See, that is censorship.
That
you
is it.
You can't cut it out now because we've got a good joke.
I am the uncensorer.
So, Kirsten, the lives of Tao. Do you agree with Jim's summation? Not the plot summation, but his view that it's a fun book. I'm not going to give an opinion. I'm just going to put the pressure on you to give an opinion.
I really hated this book.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I can see the fun.
Why did you hate it?
I can see the fun. It's just two main reasons, and I will say up front that I'm really not the kind of reader, especially over the last few years, who is able to push aside some aspect of the book that is just really irritating and like okay. The rest of the book. As when I went later after I'd read it and hunted down some reviews to see what other people thought, a lot of people seemed to do, because a lot of reviews were pointing out this problem I had with the book, but going, but hey, it was fun anyway. And it's like, I can't do that. So it was sort of two levels. On the level of actually the writing, I lost confidence in the book very early on, because there seemed to be a lot of... carelessness, and some of this is I think an editing problem as well.
Okay.
Two very specific examples. You have Tao, who's this very wise, incredibly old alien, who notices things and knows a lot and is very good at pinpointing stuff. And you have a female character, Sonia, who is described when we see Sonia, and she is a shade under 2 meters tall, curvy and athletic, but slender, and weighing 50 kilos. And it's like, what the 50 kilos? I would be emaciated for a woman who's almost 2 meters tall. That's like, and I kind of went, huh. And there was another bit where Rowan's going to work and he's running late for work. He has breakfast and whatever, and he leaves his apartment at quarter to the hour. I forget what the hour was, but quarter to the hour. And he has to go through his apartment, down to wherever his car's parked, get in his car, park his car away from work because he doesn't like paying for parking, walk the 6 long blocks to his building where he works, go up the elevator to the floor where he works, and he gets there at just... a shade past the hour. It's like 15 minutes. It's like...
Aren't you being pernickety, Kirsten?
I'm not being pernickety. They're two examples, but they were like throughout the book. So I just felt... Okay. I lacked confidence in how the book was built, because it seemed to have all of these little... And all of them just throw me out of the book. It's like... But,
sure.
But they were the little things, and they were like... I'm more like, grr, angry robot editors, why aren't you doing your job?
They're probably listening to this right now.
Because really, that's you know, the author has a lot in their head and they're putting a lot on the page, and really things like that is really the editor's job to come back later and go, hey, do you know how much a 2 meter woman
Because in the first draft, Sonia might have been 1 meter tall.
Exactly, right. He may have moved where he worked. I mean, this is an editorial job, but it did shake my faith in the book itself.
That makes sense.
But the thing which made me angry, stabby actually, made me stabby, was the absolute unrelenting male gaze from, may I say, most half the time, an alien who actually, even though these aliens refer to themselves with male and female pronouns, why do they refer to themselves with male and female pronouns? They Tao actually posits the metaphor that they're more like amoeba. They don't have any sexual reproduction. They're self-reproducing, which is a little wrong as well, because amoebas.
But wasn't the idea that they're influenced by their hosts, and therefore they've sort of.
But when?
Why?
But if they influence us so much, actually, why are
Well, there's going to be that sort of feedback loop, isn't there? I didn't have a problem with that, because I assumed that they'd become. Used to gender. I mean, they've been in our bodies
for thousands of years. In our bodies, and they've been in our heads, and they're reading our minds for thousands and thousands of years. But as we know, Ian, humans aren't binary gendered. So,
okay,
have the aliens adopted this construct and actually taken it upon themselves? And why is the alien Tao also observing Sonia and Jill with this, aren't they hot kind of? Because every time Sonia's mentioned, or another woman, in fact, it's not just, you know, that her luxurious black hair is remarked upon. The fact that she's really gorgeous is remarked upon, and it's unrelenting. And if it was just from Rowan, that would be fine, because that's who he is. But it's from Tao, it's from the book as well, because this is not a first person narrative. So it's from the book and it's from Tao, and it's just
is it
like,
from Tao though?
Yeah,
it's from Rowan.
Tao plays Cyrano de Bergerac to Rowan. He sets it. Oh, he's horrible.
Yeah, but I think that's just because he's helping out. I don't think it's because he has.
No, he is. No, Tao.
No, I'll let you jump in, Jim. Sorry, I was getting a bit right of the critic there. You know,
Tao makes several comments, and it's like, really, you're the alien. You should be slapping this guy, and he's actually only slapping the guy because Rowan's a bit shy. Instead of slapping Rowan for going, you know, the things you're thinking are just...
Yeah, I mean, there is that bit where Tao's basically saying, see what I did for you there? Aren't I great?
Yeah, aren't I...
Not those exact words, but that's sort of...
sleazy alien friend.
Yeah.
But, so there was... And then that, and even that, like, it's sort of... It's stuff you kind of go, okay, I'll go with the story. And then at the end of the book, and we are going to spoil the ending for anyone who hasn't read the book, wants to read the book, leave now.
Oh, look, everyone's left. No more audience.
At the end of the book, you've got the situation where he double damsels his female characters. So you've got Sonia and you've got Jill, who is kind of a cardboard cutout, really. We don't get to see much except Rowan thinks she's hot and she's a smart lawyer and she conveniently travels a lot, so she doesn't have to actually be in his life very much. But they get kidnapped by the bad guys. There's even, like, I think Wesley Chu kind of knows what he's doing, and he maybe makes an ironic comment because their code name for the rescue mission is that they're the princesses. So it kind of implies that he knows about the damseling trope, but he's doing it anyway. And they are... And actually, when I read the word princess, I thought, that's really cool. He's actually going to do something with this because he's acknowledging it. But he doesn't. They don't get rescued. And in fact, Sonia, who throughout the entire book... is amazing. She's strong. She's incredibly capable. She's very smart. She can put Rowan on his ass more times than he can stand up from. This is how she's drawn. She's this amazingly competent, physically competent, intellectually competent character. And at the end, her and Jill, who's a civilian, she I have no problem with Jill not knowing what to do in the situation. No problem at all. But Sonia, kidnapped, not bound, not gagged, just has a hood on her head like a falcon and goes all passive. It's like, when will you take the hood off so I can talk again and do anything? It's really... That just shocked me so much that she turned into Falcon Woman, and it's like, no, she should be... Like, the guy, she should be kicking his... Like, headbutting from the back of the head and saying something, and I expected them to be gagged, but they took the hood off. There's no gag. There's no nothing, and I just... Literally, Jill and Sonia are out of that whole final action scene. They say nothing. They're mentioned, so you know they're there for the good guy and the bad guy to fight over, and that's it. And it just... And, yeah, I there's stuff I liked about the book, but ultimately, that running through it and the way the ending happened, it was just like, no, I can't do this. I can't do it. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry.
I am the anti-fun.
Look what you did, Jim.
Go ahead.
I mean, they're...
It's okay. It's okay to like problematic things, Jim. I don't begrudge you for like, because I can see all the fun in the book as well. It's just for me, the fun was way outweighed by the unfun.
No, and I can't disagree with any of what you're saying. Mm. I mean, it's not a perfect book by any means. And part of it is just the way I read is... You notice much more detailed stuff than I do. And I'm just kind of skimming through at 11 at night.
Actually, I noticed the 50 kilos thing and just thought it was a typo, because there is no way she could possibly have weighed 50 kilos and been alive.
I know. It's just so...
And there...
It's all muscle.
I mean,
it's worse. Yes. Like, she should weigh 100 kilos if it's all muscle.
The one other piece that I found, and it's not just this book, it's something I've seen in a lot of stories that bugs me, and it's a personal quirk, is that storyline of these horrible things that happened are not our fault.
Yes, this is the thing I had a problem with the book. The aliens, it's all the aliens' fault, yeah.
And it makes sense for the book, it fits for the story, I can buy into it, but... I hate that, because at the same time, humans can be really dickish, and we need to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
We are perfectly capable of screwing up all by ourselves.
Yeah,
but it's both. It's not just that we can be dickish, we can be brilliant as well, and this undermines both that. It says not only are we not brilliant, because Shakespeare, by the way, was an alien as well, had an alien host.
And Galileo.
And everyone else, but when we do shitty things, it's not us, it's the aliens. So, yeah, it's both sides of the coin. And I actually thought that, again, like you, Kirsten, I thought that Chu was going to comment on that in some way or undermine or play with that idea, but it just seems to be a fact of the it's a structure of the novel. It is what it is, and it actually got to me at a point, because I mean, I have the same view. For example, the Shakespeare argument, that Shakespeare didn't write his own plays, he couldn't have, because he was working class, da 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 da, he wouldn't have been able to write that sort of thing, had to have been an aristocratic person or someone high up with the Queen, etc., etc., etc. And you know, that always upsets me, because of course it's got a class element to it, and it undermines that people can just be brilliant. And here it's not obviously making the class argument. Wesley's not making that argument, but it is doing the same thing. It's essentially undermining all of humanity to say, well, all our great achievements, whether good or bad, are because of these aliens. So it's sort of, you sort of feel, shit, we wouldn't have got out of the views. We were just flopped, you know.
Having read the second book,
and I haven't, so... Yeah.
Right, and I'm not going to spoil much of that or anything, but I think looking at what he does in the second book and where he seems to be going for book three, I do have some faith that some of this is going to get addressed, which doesn't change anything for if you read the first book, because the first book has to stand on its own. But there is... how to not spoil it.
Yes, we shouldn't spoil the second book.
After Rowan dies, then there is a drastic shift in some of the dynamics between human and alien. And I'm very curious as to how that's going to play out in book three.
And that sounds interesting. I just wish he'd done that in the first book.
Or not necessarily done it, but you... Because it is a problem when you have a trilogy that, yes, if you're going to set up something that you're then going to undermine, it might be really hard. I mean, you kind of need a book to maybe set it up, but there should be, some foreshadowing, something that the reader can go, but, yeah, hang on a minute, that's kind of interesting. It's hard, but you know, writing's hard. It's hard to do. It's hard to do that.
It is, though, to go back to your positive points, because I mean, you know, we can smack this book around. Shit, we do that on the podcast all the time. No, we don't. Not all the time.
Most of the time, we don't.
Usually, when other people recommend stuff for us, I don't know what is it. We haven't got to the Bujold yet.
No, sorry.
It is very cinematic. I've got to give that. And it's a book that I know you, Kirsten, would have had the annoyance, but I found it was just so easy to read, and that, it, yes. that, that I always look at, I come back to your lack of confidence in the author, but I
not the author, the book. There's a difference.
Okay, the editor. Okay, but I always look at the raw storytelling ability, because there are just so many people who just don't have that, writers, who don't have that knack. The ability to pace, the ability to get you involved, the ability to, for you to like the characters or not like them, but to manipulate you as the reader, to take the take the reader on the journey you want to take them on. That is not an easy thing to do. And I think that that's there, there. At least I found that. The stuff that annoyed me, which we've discussed, isn't a storytelling issue. That's a thematic or plot issue. But the ability to just to tell a cracking good yarn is there in its drives, which is why I was tempted to read the second book, probably more so than you, Kirsten. I think you might want to burn the second book. But
I'm perfectly happy for other people to read these books. They're just absolutely not for me.
Yeah, well, I was because you can see it there. I mean, it's the same with have you heard of the saying "piss in your pocket"? Is that a
new one? No, that's a new one.
No, it's Australian.
It's actually
thing. Is it an Australian?
Yeah, thing? No, it is. It is. But I'm saying it's like a positive thing.
Yeah, to piss in your pocket.
Well,
yeah.
not want to piss in your pocket.
Yeah, to not want to do that. Yes, because you wouldn't want me to urinate in your pocket. I don't know. Do you have good pockets?
This jacket has like 38 pockets, so the entire audience
rich
could...
target environment. Ian.
Anyway.
Anywho,
so what were you saying?
Yes, well, what I was going to say is that I don't want to piss in your pocket, but your novel also has that storytelling chops to it. It's got that ability to tell a story in a way that is compelling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Even if you have issues with it, I'm not saying I do, but if you do, that there's that ability to pull the reader through, and Wesley does that in droves, and that's it's all it's paced really, really well. At least I liked it. And very cinematic. I've got to say, I struggle with some authors to understand conceptually where they're going and how they describe the world. I mean, yes, it's based in our world, so it's pretty easy. But still, I think the fight scenes and all that, it's all well choreographed, and the landmarks are all there. It's vibrant enough that I could see it all.
It's interesting. I actually looked up a bit about Wesley Chu himself, and he's an actor and a stuntman.
Well, that definitely comes out in the book.
Yeah, I read an interview, he said he choreographed in meticulous detail the fight scenes, especially the one at the end. And his first draft was woeful because he had written down in meticulous detail every single movement of the hand and where they gripped and how they turned. And his first reader sort of went, "You really need to tone this down." He said he basically wrote it so someone could recreate that fight if they needed to, blow by blow.
It's a novel, not an instruction manual.
Exactly.
And Wes is also a martial artist.
Yes.
So I'm sure that was a piece of it too.
Yeah. The action was, I mean, there was stuff I really appreciated. I appreciated the fact that for the majority of the history that we're being told, it was non-Western history, because Tao spent a lot of time in what we now know as the Middle Eastern area and in Asia. So a lot of the history we get, we get side references to Galileo and Abraham Lincoln and pretty up there Western characters in history, but most of the history that we're being retold is non-Western, which was really good. It wasn't a case of, well, it's all Abraham Lincoln and Queen Elizabeth, and actually that was the other thing. I may be wrong, but I don't know that there was a single female historical figure actually mentioned throughout the book.
I think some of that is back to the gender thing that you were talking about, because I was thinking, I don't remember if Tao ever has a non-male host.
Tao never says he does. But the thing is, even if the aliens have gendered themselves, they quite explicitly in the book, that doesn't seem to matter about their host, because you have Yol, who's gendered male, going into Paula. So it doesn't matter. They can obviously cross genders into their hosts, but if there is one mentioned, it's one in the little passing references, but all of the major historical heavyweights who are mentioned, whether it's in more detail because it's someone Tao has, I was going to say possessed, that's not really the right word.
No, it's not. Inhabited. It's absolutely not a possession.
No, in fact, they can't control their human hosts unless their human hosts are unconscious. So,
which did result in some really funny bits, I have to say.
Even the passing references, I'm sure they were all men. So not all white men, which was good, but pretty much all men, which was interesting in itself.
Whenever you say interesting, Kirsten.
Stabby. And it's one of those things because as I said on the podcast last month, you can be reading something and there can be a whole lot of good stuff about it, but there's this bit of grit there and it's like eating, you know, a really nice meal and then there's this bit of grit that just you can't get out of your mouth and the rest of the meal might be nice and enjoyable, but it's like, but this...
Yeah, but for you, this sounds like a boulder, not a bit of grit. It sounds like a huge rock was in your mouth.
But that's what I'm saying. That's what it feels like. It's like there was other stuff in the book which was really good. And as I said, I can see the fun. I can see it. It's right there. The fun is there. I just, there's stuff standing in front of the fun for me going, but.
But it didn't work for you.
No, it didn't work for me at all.
Amblin, do you have a thought on the novel?
And this is probably sounding weird, but I almost read it as a movie rather than a book.
It's
and it makes
very
sense
cinematic.
To me that now that
it's
he is
cinematic.
A stuntman because that's how it played as I was reading it. Like I could see it unfolding as if I were watching a movie.
And that's not an easy thing to do.
And that's what the experience of it was like, especially that first scene with Edward. It was like the beginning to a spy thriller.
Yeah.
You can almost cut away to the James Bond intro after that.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very visual book.
Did you zip through it, Amblin? Did you?
Yes. Read it very quickly. And it's pictures all the way. You know, you can always see what is happening as it's happening. And the fight scenes were done particularly well, so it makes sense that he put all that time into them.
See, I find fight scenes incredibly boring to read, usually, but I wasn't in this case. This is going to be political, so you can edit this out, Kirsten, if you want to. But the recent Hugo ballot, I read the... I haven't finished yet. I said edit it out when you feel the urge. I read the Sad Puppy novel on the ballot, so that was the Larry Correa novel, and that's wall-to-wall action scenes, mostly involving guns and big guns, and I couldn't tell you how dull that was. It just felt like people just blowing the shit out of other people. And it didn't help that the enemy were the Japanese and... Yeah, anyway, I won't go into all that stuff because then you will have to edit it out. But if you compare, you know, it's funny because one pundit called Larry the greatest action writer in the 20th and 21st century, so which I found a bit funny. But there's a lot going on in Lives of Tau. There's a lot of action. And it could get very boring very quickly because it's there's a bit of Perils of Pauline in it as well. Which is that a trope? That's the damsel trope, isn't it?
That's the damsel. The double damseling.
Okay, thank you. But it still felt exciting and thrilling, whereas the Sad Puppy novel felt less so because it just felt like one big, clusterfuck of action. I can edit that out too.
This isn't a series of set pieces. I mean, it does have a cinematic quality. It doesn't feel like one of those big, dumb action films where it really is just set piece, set piece, set piece, and a bit of dialogue to link them all. The other thing I did like about it is that Rowan doesn't become this amazing kick-ass superhero like straight away or even in a couple of months. It takes him, I think it's like there's over a year in the progress of the book.
Yeah.
That was great, but it did raise one thing. How is it that they haven't tracked him down? I know they kill off his social records and that and he's person non grata, but they do follow him or they do uncover him at one point. I couldn't get in my head how he's still living in that flat. 12 months later, have they haven't firebombed the flat or killed someone close to him? You know, they haven't, that the enemy that is, not that they haven't actually hunted him down. I know, I guess I understand Tao's an expert at staying hidden, but.
But he wasn't hidden. He was home.
Yeah, he was home, exactly. I've belted up the baddies, off home I go for a cup of tea and,
chat to the roommate.
Chat to the roommate. That was just something that again, bugged me a little bit, but, it's explained in the novel. It's not entirely a plot.
Well, they did stop trying to kill him after a while, didn't they? They decided that he wasn't
worth killing.
There was window that if we get him now
when he's easy to become,
and then the more Tau had time to train him and prepare him, it's sort of a Highlander
it's
thing.
It's just that first third.
I have prepared him for you, Kurgan.
Very good. In that first third, they do come across him in the nightclub scene or whatever it is, so they know what he looks like at that point.
Yep.
And yet there's then a whole lot of... They don't do the cliche thing of taking best friend or the mother or whatever, and I've got her. They do
they
towards
take
the end.
The girl.
Okay, that is at the end. That's
and the other girl has.
Okay,
a crush
fine.
On.
All right, I'll shut
and
up.
And they put
now.
Hoods on their head.
I'm just digging a hole for Wesley. Just digging a hole up.
But they do. That's what I'm saying. They do. They do get damseled, both of them.
Yeah,
okay. Like, it's really it's unnecessary. That's the thing. I get what's driving that scene is Rowan versus Sean, but I can't remember the alien Chiva. It's the good guy versus the bad guy, and the young naive recruit versus the old stalwart who's maybe gotten a bit too complacent. And yeah, I can see the dynamics of how that scene's set up.
And there's a helicopter.
Except, you know, in my head the whole time, there's two women wearing hoods just going dum da dum da dum da dum da dum in the background. And
I don't think they're humming to themselves.
They weren't gagged. They might have been. I don't know. And yeah, it's just like, oh, come on. It's not that hard. It doesn't seem that hard to me to not do stuff like that.
I've got this image in their head of the two of them going, say Geronimo, say Geronimo, say Geronimo. That's a song? It's quite popular at the moment, that song.
You're an idiot.
Okay.
It made me stabby. What can I say?
Should we move on to the next? Should we move on to the next book, or do you want to keep stabbing?
No, I'm done
Anyone
stabbing.
Else got Jim Amblin? Any other thoughts?
No.
Never recommend a book for us again, Jim. That's the key message.
I was just, you know, when you brought up my book in relation to this, I was waiting for Kirsten to go, oh, yes, those books make me stabby, too. And that's why we put you on the other side of the room, Kirsten.
And here's all the reasons why.
Yeah. Actually, I thought you were going to start throwing mints at me, so we should have a screen.
So, our second book was, as Amblin beautifully described, You've Got a Job for Life on our podcast, because it was well done, was Curse of Chalion. Now, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I believe a 2001 Hugo Award winner. Am I close?
Hugo nominated.
Didn't it win, or did it win the World Fantasy?
No, it was nominated for the Hugo, the World Fantasy, and the Locus Awards. It won the Mythopoeic Award.
Didn't it win the Hugo?
No, I'm reading it off
second
the
book.
Paper.
Oh, the second book won the Hugo. Thank you. Thank you, audience member who isn't Kirsten.
Yes, we had a lovely audience member advising us that the sequel to Curse of Chalion actually won the Hugo, not Curse of Chalion, as I've got on my paper. See, I have it on the paper.
Yeah, well, I don't trust what you've printed out there. Well, I mean, is that even a website? And, you know, I don't know what that is. Anywho, so I have to say that I love Bujold generally. I've read not all, but a good chunk of the Vorkosigan books. And my friend Ori has been pushing the Curse of Chalion me for 13 years. Is it 2001? Was I right about that, at
yes,
least?
Yes, you were.
Thank God. So had been pushing on. So when you actually did recommend this, after you'd recommend the four or five other books that were all about 1,400 pages long, including, I mean, she recommended Infinite Jest, and we said, well, we've done that one. No, that's a joke. You didn't recommend that. But, you know, when you after that, and you said The Curse of Charlie, and I said, fuck yeah. To myself, there was no one. I mean, Jules, my wife, said, why are you swearing in front of the kids again? And I said, I don't know, it's just a Tourette's thing, I don't know what it is. But no, I said, no, I've got a great email, and it's The Curse of Chalion that we're reading. And she said, I don't know that book, so I don't really care. So, yes, I, though, enjoyed reading
Ian's
it. Yes.
Stories are awesome.
I never know where to stop. I wasn't let down. I wasn't sure how she would go with fantasy, and I suppose it wasn't. I know it's not her first fantasy novel. She had done fantasy prior.
Yeah.
Somewhere in between the Vorkosigan books, I can't remember what it's called, but
The Spirit Ring.
Thank you. In fact, it might even be one of her first novels, The Spirit Ring.
It was her first fantasy novel, though.
I really dislike a well-educated audience. Okay, just want to say that. So I know she'd done it before, but I thought, with Bujold, this one was a bit slow to start for me, but it's so easy to fall in love with every single one of her characters. It's just, even the ones you don't like, it's just so easy to fall in love with her world, so easy. It becomes, I suppose, a bit comforting, a bit cosy, which isn't necessarily a good thing. You don't necessarily feel challenged, but... Shit! I'm saying that as a generalisation, not about this particular book, because I think there are challenging elements to this book.
Okay.
But just again, it comes back to that ability to tell a story, I got quite weepy at the end. Did you weep? Did you weep, Amblin?
Yeah, I cry in Hallmark card commercials. So I am no test. You know, the one with the little old ladies all alone, and she has no mail. It's very upsetting.
I'm going to see if that is on YouTube, and I'm going to put a link in.
So thank you for recommending it. And thank you, Jim, for recommending your book, but especially... and as you said, it's very much a story of a broken man, and yet not filled with angst. There is angst in it. He's not a happy bloke, and he does doubt himself a lot, etc. But it's not. Yeah,
he's very stoic, though.
Yeah, it's more stoic than woe is me.
Accepting remarkably sometimes accepting of his past and what's happened to him.
And I do love, the thing I love the most of the whole book is that the whole plot turns on a guy on a horse throwing our main character the wrong coin. Because if he'd thrown him a... because he throws him a gold, I think a gold coin rather than the penny he was meant to throw
him. Yeah, like a copper or something.
Yeah, and if he'd thrown him just a copper, he wouldn't have been able to have, you know, got washed, got properly dressed, been presentable when he went to the, you know, it would have been a lot harder for him, yet because he got a gold coin. The fact that it all turns on just that one little slip up.
But what it turns on, because the implication is that it was actually the gods who made the guard throw that piece. Because the whole thing turns on the gods moving in circles around Kaz and the players in the book. And
I like the way you find that out quite slowly. Happen.
Yes, you do. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how everything that. Yeah, it's that subtlety that does, and that's what I'm saying. It's not, when I said cozy, it is very cozy, but it is also challenging that there's that lovely thread running through that you don't really figure out until towards the last third of the book. So yes, I have more to say about it, but I'll let other people speak.
And why did you choose the book, Amberlynn?
Well, all my other ones were too long. so that was, you know, one that was short. It's one that I've always enjoyed. It's a book that you can read, and you can actually just read that one too, because though the other books in that series are set in the same world, they're not the same characters.
Do they reference the first book at all?
Yeah, okay. They do. They do reference the first book. But you could just read this as a standalone, which I thought is nice, because then people, you know, don't have to buy into a series if they don't want to.
No, it is. It's a very self-contained
And story. I also think that it's increasingly hard to find just really nicely written fantasy books these days, and I just think it's a really well-told fantasy and a very different pace from the Miles books, which are fast, you know, reflecting the character.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I haven't actually read any Bujold before this one, which people seem shocked. I don't know why.
that makes me stabby.
I know. I have had so many people go, what? It's like, but I have had the Miles Verkotigan saga thrust upon me and from several angles. Like, well, you must read these, and I will. I just have
no. You won't.
No, actually, I do want to now, because her writing was it did pull you through the book. You stand back and you realise so much actually happens in this book in terms of the machinations and the politics, but it doesn't feel like it's this overly complicated, dense story. You're just kind of reading along, and this stuff is happening, a lot of it in the background from your central characters, and she's sort of setting up all these pieces behind there, and you're getting glimpses of them, but it doesn't feel like this big, heavy, dense political kind of, you know, intrigue book. It's much more about Kaz and the two, they are princesses, but this is Royce and Royce and
I'm not Roya good with names.
And Royena, I think, are the royal family names. It's about them, and it's about Kaz, and it's about the world they're kind of negotiating, which was really cool. But it's this big, complex stuff that's happening that you get by the end of the book, but it hasn't felt like that all the way
Can
through.
Can I just jump in? You said, Amberlynn, nice fantasy.
Just nicely told.
Nicely told, as distinct from obviously badly told.
I just think that sometimes... we had badly told. Yeah. but also I often think that people try to do too much with it instead of just telling a really good fantasy story.
So are you having a crack there at Game of Thrones? Is that what you...
I have some issues with the portrayal of women in the Game of Thrones series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we should talk.
But it's interesting because written in the early 2000s, it's before, obviously, the big grimdark side of things. I mean, this whole idea that grimdark only existed for the last 5 years is obviously wrong. It existed well before that. However, that sort of trope is new. But yet it doesn't flinch away from violence. It doesn't flinch away from bad things happening to people.
Sorry, I was just going to say, would you consider this to be grimdark fantasy?
Well, no, I wouldn't. Not that I really understand the definition, because it seems to me that grimdark is stories where people are slogging it, soldiers mostly, and or mercenaries are slogging it out in the bogs and are covered in shit and are slicing people's heads off. That seems to me basically.
Jim, would you agree that sort of description of grimdark?
Sounds grim, dark.
Well, because only because about 30 minutes of every episode of Game of Thrones is that, and the other 30 minutes is the royalty. So,
of the television show, though.
Yeah. Because okay. I haven't read the books. I'm not going to invest my time in that stuff. God. But it's interesting that you use the word nice, because it doesn't flinch, but it isn't gratuitous either in terms of. I mean, there's obviously rape going on in some points.
Not to any of the on-screen characters,
isn't it? Rape is threatened.
yes,
that's right.
That's what I mean. Like to all of the on-screen characters, nothing. When you step back, you realize nothing bad actually happened to any of the on-screen characters. Like they all live at the end. Sorry, spoilers.
I'd say pretty shitty stuff happens to Kaz.
Yeah, no, but pre-book.
No, even in the book, he goes through he gets a bit Bruce Willis. He goes through a bit.
Yeah, but as you do in the challenges of a book, right? But I'm saying they all live. They all, well, the intimation is happily ever after to some extent. They're kind of all promoted at the end. I mean, it is an ending that is it's a happy ending, right, Emily?
Yeah,
it is. You don't lose any of the characters you love. They might get put through some traumatic events of varying degrees, but yeah, there's nothing sort of indelible that happens to them. The magic sort of god stuff that happens with Kaz gets neatly resolved at the end, and he's actually made better than when he started. So everyone's kind of nicely ensconced.
I think Bujold does that well without you feeling, oh God, it's sentimental crap.
No, I don't think it's sentimental.
No, okay. Well, if there's one, I'm interested to know what you all think. One criticism I had is that I know I've said Game of Thrones a couple of times, but it actually reminded me of Downton Abbey. And has at the core, and it's possibly a symptom of this sort of fantasy, that only interesting things happen to rich people or aristocrats.
No, I would agree with that, yeah. But I do think that is a thing of that particular. It's a fantasy thing in general.
Which is probably why Grimdark comes along. Because Grimdark often is probably more, and I'm going to do air quotes here, working class than this sort of fantasy, which really does focus on. I mean, Kaz himself is a lord, so to speak. He says he's a lord of not very much, but he is still
a lord.
Yeah.
I have to say, look, I like the book, but it's not the fault of this book, because I think this, objectively speaking, as much as you can be objective about the arts, this is a very good, as Amberlynn says, it's a very good example of this type of fantasy book, and it's well written, it's complex without being burdensome, weird. But it reminded me again, because this is a very good example of this type of fantasy, why I don't actually really read this type of fantasy. And I think it comes down to what Ian just said, in that this is a book about royalty and about those in power, and those without power are barely mentioned. And when they are, it's funny because there would be these little mentions from time to time, like Iselle, who's the princess, the royess, gets promoted in court for various reasons, mostly involving death. Then, because of her higher status in the court, she's given more income from various other, we would think of them as counties. And so Kaz, who is her secretary tutor guy, and who he teaches her stuff, he also keeps her books kind of thing, a PA now.
He's great with myop.
He's great with myop. There's this offhand remark that he makes where he's got a lot of work to do now, because now there's all this extra income coming in, and all those counties are pesky because they're going on about how they've not paid their taxes because their crops have failed and tax collectors are oppressive and blah blah blah, and it's this offhand reference, but it's like, Kaz, the crops probably did fail, people are probably starving, and you're worried because you're doing a bit more of book work, and it's these little things in there, and that's like, when it comes right down to it, I don't care. These characters I care about in this book, but I don't actually really care about this weight of all these stories that are collecting in the speculative genre. And it's not just fantasy. I mean,
but it is very symptomatic of this sort.
Yeah, and it is the stories of, as it were, the rich and powerful with scant regard to those who aren't the rich and powerful, where a lot of the stories are.
Let's open that to the floor.
Did not hate this book, but I wanted a comment I've made on the podcast previously. I often read a book, and what I find myself wanting is what I refer to as the shadow book, and it's the book that about something else that the book is tangential to, and it's like, well, that's the book I wanted to read, which doesn't make Curse of Chalion a bad book. It's just it's not the book I want to read. And that's just me. This is not really my genre. And I think, when Ian and I were talking earlier, it's like that's kind of it. It's about this group of people that, while I acknowledge they have the power, they are the ones shaping the politics, and trickle down to that, they are the ones shaping the lives of everyone beneath them and what they do. But, again, this book reminds us that they're the ones taking the money from the poor people and not seeming to care too much about what people are doing, because they're involved in the court intrigues and things, which in their lives are incredibly important. But it does mean that the lives of everyone beneath them is not, and we're invited to take this same perspective as readers, because we're not meant to care about everyone beneath them. We're caring about the intrigues at court.
I feel like we've just damned an entire genre.
No, it's not the entire... It is not the entire genre.
Amblin, your thoughts?
I would agree with that. I mean, I enjoy this book. I like about this book that I think it does have some focus on the responsibility of power rather than just having power for power's sake.
Yep.
And there is also a narrative in there about what happens to people who don't have it through Kaz's experiences. But these type of books that tell the story of the royals, at the end of the day, tell the story of the royals.
Yeah.
And I would like to see many, many more books written that don't tell that story, and there's really not.
And that point out that those stories are worth telling.
Yeah.
I'm not articulating it all that well, but it is this sort of neglect of all the other stories, and they're vast and they're myriad and they're important.
But at the end of the day, it's not the purpose of the book.
No, it's not. And as I said, it's not this book, but when you have a lot of these books, they form a larger cultural pattern.
Because I think, agreed. But I think, as Amblin says, the key to this is about the responsibility of power and how that power is wielded. And it's not a novel that's about the thoughts and views of the working class or however you want to put it. I mean, look, same goes with Downton Abbey. I mean, that's about powerful people doing powerful things, and we love watching it because, there's that escapist element. We wish we were them. Well, we do. I mean, we wish we were them. We wish we had servants. Anyone who watches it, me included, has that fantasy. I do. Just because, I don't necessarily believe that I should have servants and, grossly rich people are... usually gross. That doesn't mean I don't have a fantasy of being, all powerful and, having, I could spend money on all the books I want and have my own library and just sit in there and read all day.
Modest fantasies about power. I'll have all the books and I'll read all day. You're kind of power I can live with.
Yeah, well. Oh, and, of course, kill anyone who doesn't agree with me.
We're coming down to it now.
Anyway, Jim, did you have any particular...
I have to throw myself upon the mercy of the podcast. I did not get a chance to read the book.
That's all right. If you don't mind, we will edit that out and never speak to you again.
That seems the appropriate response.
So it's as I said, it's not this book. This book is good. It's just... And it's the same with, all the other books. They're all in themselves good. They all have valid reasons for talking about these stories and these people.
But you're making me feel squeaky for liking it.
No, but that's what I mean. They're all good, okay? It's like books that are... that have problematic elements that people are pointing out, that they have the character who's all the characters of colour are sidekick characters, or all the things that happen, and people say, but yeah, but within the book, this is why. And it's like, yes, absolutely, I can see that within the book, that's absolutely why you did that, that's absolutely why that happened. But it's the larger cultural patterns of when you get the mass of this and what that says about the stories we value and the stories we don't. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Curse of Chalion, because there isn't, and it's a fine example.
But a lot of it comes down to agency as well. And powerful people, usually the ones who have agency, you know, given the fact that they're powerful. What's nice about this is that a lot of the power resides in women, not in I mean, it does reside in men, obviously. And in fact, it's a battle with Kaz doing the Machiavellian stuff to give that power back to who it should go to, which happened to be, in this case, the Royess. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and she herself and her handmaiden. Did handmaiden sounds terrible? And you're giving me that look, but I don't have the book right here in front of me.
Yeah, no, I don't think it was handmaiden, but there is a word for her lady in waiting.
Lady in waiting. Characters with genuine agency. It's not just that Kaz is saving the day for them.
Absolutely.
What I loved was how the Royce makes genuine. Gets Kaz. In fact, it's her tactical decisions that Kaz doing the things that he does. So, which I thought was wonderful. And yes, it does have slightly a bit of that cliche that when they find the prince, who coincidentally was on the same boat as Kaz. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. But when I come across the
But again, but this is but what this book is doing is it's saying that none of that stuff is coincidence.
No.
It's all the working of the gods.
And all books should do that. You know, whether
all
they're
books
whether
of the gods.
Yes, whether they're mimetic. But go back to the Greeks, whether it's mimetic or not, it should be, if this is a coincidence, no, it's not. It's a working of the gods.
Oh, dear.
I had a point, but I lost it. But the point, no, the thing was that, no, I don't know what it was. My point was that I liked it, and thank you again. Jim, your thoughts on power response, just the general comment about the genre in terms of the stories being told through the eyes of the powerful people. And
I would agree with what Kirsten was saying, that you can have really good books, but also that these books highlight what's missing, you know, and what the genre doesn't have. And there are a lot of those empty spaces in the genre that... It's not that nobody should ever tell this story, because, yes, it's a good story. It's interesting. It's entertaining. But why do we keep... It's like with my kids. There is more to eat than chicken tenders and French fries. And that's a perfectly cromulent meal. You can have chicken tenders and French fries. But there's other stuff
there. The examination of power from the top is good and necessary, but you can examine power from the bottom up as well. And I think those stories you talk about, we tell these ones because these are the powerful people who make changes, but you can tell powerful stories about those situations from another angle. It's obviously a cultural bias we have. We do like telling stories about the rich and powerful, and not just in fantasy. Come on, I mean, Real Housewives of wherever in the world you happen to be. I mean, this is what we do.
Do you watch the Real Housewives? Before you attack it, do you watch it?
Elisa made me watch Real Housewives of Melbourne.
No, that was terrible.
I felt quite
ill. Do you watch Real Housewives of... You're not a real fan, Kirsten.
No, I'm totally not a fan. This is what I'm saying.
Oh.
But what I'm saying is it's not just in the fantasy genre. As a culture at the moment, we do seem to be obsessed with the rich and the powerful, and whether that's coming from want to be that.
The reason I brought it wasn't joking entirely about The Real Housewives. The reason why I brought that up is because those shows specifically point fun at these people through their own words and their own actions. And if you watch, I often, because my wife watches them, not to denigrate her in any way, it's perfectly good viewing. She does call me in when they do these season wrap episodes. So what they do is they've done their 13 episodes, and then the normal host gets in the women, the Real Housewives, and usually sometimes their partners. Now, these people, by the end of the season, hate each other with a passion that... The internet can barely reflect. go for any of the flame wars that have happened in the last 12 months in regard to science fiction fandom. It's nothing compared to the hatred these people have for each other. And they're all sitting near each other. And just watching them just eviscerate each other for an hour, and the screeches and the yelling, and you're just sitting there and you think, thank God I don't live that life.
But then you could have all the books you wanted and read all day.
Did I mention the? I said it was fantasy. and it's not to poke fun at rich, vapid people, but frankly, it is.
It's a lot of fun, those shows, rich, vapid people.
Yeah.
But again, even though we're poking fun at them, we're still obsessed with the rich and the powerful.
No, because of the way they. Because of the way they deconstruct their own lives and destroy themselves. It's why I love Mad Men so much, because you see, where have we gone on to Mad Men now? Because how Don Draper essentially destroys everything about that is good about himself through 7 seasons of the show. Spoiler.
I'm sorry, there was something good about Don Draper? I think I missed
that. Yes, there are, but he self-destructs constantly. And that's interesting. Now, in Curse of Chalion, there are no Don Draper characters particularly. Could have been an interesting book if there was, or an advertising firm in the Chalion universe, good reason. But it is still very much. But I do go back to what Amblin said, that this is very much a book that is about the use of power and responsible use of power, and while it doesn't involve the working class particularly, it is very much about that idea. How that all links to the last 10 minutes of what I just said, really, it's irrelevant.
I'll string that together somehow.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, we have a few minutes. Does anyone in the audience have any questions for our lovely guests, or indeed anything we've talked about, comments, anything? Terry.
Terry asked why my wife doesn't have a name when I do the podcast. If you'd listen to the episodes, Terry, if that's your real name, you'll note that I do mention her. Her name is Julie. She doesn't have a middle name, just like me. I don't have a middle name. Yes, she often makes jokes about me going off to see the prostitutes. It's hilarious. Yes, you can edit that out.
No, well, I'm a little offended by that. We are authors. Not...
He wins. That's good.
Jim wins the podcast.
Were there any other... You can ask... go ahead.
So the question was, are there any fantasy novels that aren't grimdark but do reflect the working class or the non-top creamy echelon?
And you mean high fantasy or epic fantasy as distinct from urban or the other...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I have no idea, Kirsten.
No,
our guests.
Yes.
Well... as tacky as this is about to be, there's this series that starts with a book called Goblin Quest. And the protagonist is this little nearsighted runt of a goblin that his duty is to load muck into the fire pits. And it's this sort of caustic, gross substance that it blisters if you touches you. He is like the lowest of the low in goblin class. And a certain someone has written 3 books about this gentleman. And his companions.
I might look them up and provide links in the show notes.
And other than yourself, Jim, that was a reference to you, was it?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. Terry Pratchett, I suppose, does a bit of that as well.
Oh, yeah.
Does
a little bit of that.
But that's a sideways genre to... No, but it's high fantasy.
Well, no, you still. It might be funny, but it doesn't mean it's not taking the genre seriously.
No, I didn't say it wasn't taking the genre seriously.
Well, what were you saying? What do you mean sideways?
Words in my mouth.
How's it sideways? It's a secondary world. I mean, they may not be going.
It's not classic high fantasy.
I don't know about that.
The Pratchett books are good for showing a whole strata of that social world he's doing. And different professions within that and so on.
Well, given that we've got an audience, does anyone else want to answer the question about working class fantasy novels? Yes? All right, A Company of Ogres by Aileen Martinez. Okay.
This is what I'm saying. That's interesting. Is can we only approach power from the other, and if we're doing it in a tongue-in-cheek way? It's an interesting thought. So there was a question up the back. That was Elizabeth Moon's Paladin series.
Pakistanarian.
Yeah, which I have not read, so I don't know.
It does get pretty grim.
Okay. Okay. Well,
because you could say the same. Because you could say the same about Glenn Cook, I suppose, and he predating Grimdark as an example of someone who did, but also warriors and mercenaries and the like. But
well, okay. So if for people listening, we would love email us, tweet us, let us know if high fantasy books which aren't Grimdark, which aren't.
Which aren't written by Glenn Cook.
Hysterical comedy. What ones are? I don't know. I'd love to know. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like we need to approach that from different angles through a lens of comedy.
And yet
I thought
we were really well read, that we could just produce these answers off the top of our head.
No, we're not. We just read Wikipedia before we start recording.
It's all those Doctor Who novelisations I read for 15 years before I read a proper book.
Yeah, anywho. Totally did.
Yeah, anywho.
Would you have a definition of high fantasy, Amblin?
I wouldn't dare
throw you on the spot there.
Quite frankly.
Jim, go ahead.
Jim, high fantasy?
You're in Australia, so no one will hear anything you have to say, so it's you're safe.
Honestly, a lot of the genre divisions and subdivisions to me are just, this is where we're going to put it on the bookshelf. So that it'll sell better. So yeah, high fantasy means it goes on that part of the shelves with that kind of a cover.
Urban fantasy is much more likely to have everyman characters.
Yeah, urban fantasy, because a lot of urban fantasy is contemporary urban fantasy. So yeah, it does tend to have a lot more everyman characters because... See, this is interesting, isn't it? In our contemporary world, it's really interesting to have the characters in the books who are actually fighting the power. You know, that's the stories we want in contemporary fiction, whether it's fantasy or science fiction or general fiction. We kind of want these stories. We want the every people. We want the people who are actually going up against power of structures of some kind and succeeding. That was very cool. I'm going to repeat that. We had an audience member point out that what Terry Pratchett is doing is putting urban fantasy characters into a high fantasy setting, which is neat. That's a very neat way of phrasing it.
Should we end on that note?
We can end on that note.
I'm going to be fascinated how you read the last 20 minutes.
I know.
Because none of that...
Well, see, this is part of what being in the audience is about, because you get to hear stuff which won't end up making it onto the podcast.
Yes, everything all you guys said, that's not making
it. No, I'll try. I will try and get as much on it as I can.
Nah.
Of when we've repeated questions and comments.
Building up your hopes for no good reason.
I can turn your microphone
good
off
chunk of
right
what
now.
Good chunk of what Jim said. I ain't making it.
Okay.
Hello.
So next episode, which is indeed not next month because there is no podcast in July.
Explain why, Kirsten.
Because I'm doing a PhD and I don't have any time ever.
What's a PhD on, Kirsten?
Shut up.
Okay.
Yes, so there will be no podcast in July. We'll be back in August, and the books we're doing... Again, something a little different. We haven't recommended each other a book per se. We're doing a themed podcast, which is, I think, will make Charles Tan very happy.
By the way, he wanted me to give you a hug, Jim, so I'm hugging you now.
He's not hugging Jim now.
Oh, here we go. This will make good podcasts. Just
think I'm, yep. Podcast hug.
That was beautiful. Charles, Jim just hugged me, and let me tell you something. I know why you wanted him to hug you. It was that frisson of leather and Jim and a bit of my manly body. It was good.
I give good hugs.
Yeah, you do. If you find teeth mark on the leather, it's not my teeth. What?
Never mind.
Okay.
So next episode, we're going to do a bit of a themed one because two anthologies have been recently released this year and have generated various amounts of chatter and crunchy discussions.
Including one review on Strange Horizons that we'll probably have to mention.
Yes, and so we thought we'd actually look at them. So we're going to be reading first, hopefully, and then talking about we See a Different Frontier, a post-colonial speculative fiction anthology, which was edited by Fabio Fernandez and Jibril Al-Ayad. and Long Hidden, speculative fiction from the margins of history, edited by Rose Fox and Daniel Jose Older. Both these anthologies were crowdfunded. One was in Kickstarter and the other one I think was Peerbackers. I'm not sure. We'll look that up. But they were both crowdfunded anthologies. Obviously, as you can tell from the subtitles, dealing with more diverse subject matter than often gets put into mainstream speculative fiction anthologies. So I haven't read either of them yet.
Neither have I.
So I'm really looking forward to reading those and talking about them with you, not next month, but the month after.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yes, read those books ahead of time if you don't want them spoiled. Although, generally, when we do short story collections, you don't do a lot of spoilers because there's just so many things to get through, unlike when we talk about novels and we go straight to the end and say why we didn't like
it. And there's a bit of stabbing.
Stabbing. Okay, so please send feedback to us by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, emailing us at writerandcritic@gmail.com, follow us on Twitter, where you can talk mostly to Ian. Our Twitter handle is @writerandcritic. And don't forget to leave us ratings on iTunes if people still do that.
I just want to jump in. I know a lot of people have been asking. It's been the talk of the convention for all 1 hour that I've been at it. And the question is, where's the pony?
There's no pony, which means we're doing a bi-monthly podcast.
If you've heard the previous episode, Kirsten said that if a pony was given to her at the convention, we would do a weekly podcast. Was it weekly?
Weekly.
Yeah. You all failed.
No one's got a pony.
Well, though they do have the rest of the convention.
I get to have a life. No, it was at the podcast.
No.
The window has closed.
So you expected someone to walk a pony in?
Yes.
Okay.
I did not want to do a weekly podcast. No, I was very specific. A real live flesh and blood pony that I could take home with me.
This is basically Charles wanting a weekly
Charles
podcast.
Charles Tan did try to crowdfund me a pony.
Yes. So on that note, I would like to thank our wonderful guests.
Yes, thank you, Jim. Thank you, Amberlynn. It was wonderful to have you here.
Will you ever do it again?
Well, I think I'll let Jim answer that one. You know, I think he's had a tough time. Even with the hug?
That depends. Will we again have sort of the neutral zone?
We will. We will, my Romulan commander. We will, yeah.
Then yes, I would love to.
Oh, lovely.
And thank you very much to everyone who came along in the audience.
Give yourself a clap.
It was... It was really fun to do this with actual people in the room.
Yes.
Instead of just pretending that they were actual people.
And I think 4 is a charm. We should never do it again.
Really? I like the number 5.
Yeah, okay. It depends who the guest is next year. Anyway.
No, you can't say that, because if we can't do it for some reason, everyone will think it's because we hated the guest.
Which means we didn't hate you guys.
No, we didn't hate you guys.
That's thumbs up.
It means you didn't hate us at the beginning.
Yeah. The tech can come and unshackle us from the table now. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening, and thank you for listening at home, and we'll talk to you all in August.
Yes. Bye.
Bye.
Lean in and speak to the mic. Okay.
Do that again. It was quite erotic.
You want me to do some...
Now you're doing
test
it.
Test phrases.
That's better. Yeah. That's very nice.
Stop it.
Get what? Shh.